is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you from Burnaby, BC. Check out our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CJSF 90.1 FM to learn more about us.
You talked about Mohamed Bazoum of Niger. Mohamed Bazoum comes from a socialist party, but they have not been socialists for decades. They are basically caretakers for the United States, the French, and so on. US has the largest drone base in the world in Agadez, Niger. These guys have become caretakers for the imperialist bloc.
That's Vijay Prashad, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Vijay Prashad on Africa, from neoliberalism to independence. Almost every country in Africa was colonized by Europe. Today, while nominally sovereign, many of these countries are in the clutches of the big international banks. The old colonial masters, Britain and France, still have a foothold in Africa, but the U.S. has been pushing them aside, moving in to capture resources and markets. Washington has established an Africa command, deployed troops, and built a string of bases. But France won't let go of its grip on its former colonies. The coup in Niger, a former French colony, is not your run-of-the-mill coup. It must be understood in the context of widespread discontent with ruling elites and their collaboration with imperialism. Genuine independence is still far off for Niger and other countries in the Sahel region of West and Central Africa. To talk about these issues is Vijay Prashad. He's an internationally renowned historian and journalist. He's the director of Tricontinental and chief correspondent for Globetrotter. He's the author of many books, including Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations. I interviewed Vijay Prashad in mid-August. He was at his home in Santiago, Chile. Welcome back to the program.
So, salam alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. There are coups and there are coups. The one in Niger, ousting the elected government of Mohamed Bazoum on July 26, you say is different. How so? You make a distinction then between generals' coups and colonels' coups. Explain what you mean.
Well, look, we know that coups have a certain patina, certain understanding in the consciousness. For instance, if you go back in the history of the modern world since 1945, there have been a series of important coup d'etats. Let's take a part of the world I know very well. Take Pakistan. Pakistan wins its independence 1947. You know, it's a decent liberal government, Liaquat Ali Khan leading the government. When the left started to make its noises, and that too not in a very loud way, the military entered. There was a coup d'etat almost immediately. Now, Pakistan punctually seen generals' coups. Not only are these coups led by generals, you know, General Ayub Khan, General Yahya Khan, General Zia-ul-Haq, General Parvez Musharraf. It's not only that they are generals, but in a sense, they also represent the oligarchy of the country. They do a coup against the possibility of the diminishment of power of elites. So that when we see the coup of General Augusto Pinochet 50 years ago in Chile this year, Augusto Pinochet moves out of the barracks, not because his soldiers are unhappy, not because the rural peasantry is starving. It's not to save the country. It's to save the oligarchy in association with the United States. Those are general coups, and there are legions of them. You know, we can look at them over the last 60, 70 years, define number of them, you know, Hugo Banzer in Bolivia, and so on and so forth. In Thailand, for instance, the generals coup repeatedly, punctually, we see generals coups. The coup of General Suharto in Indonesia in 1965 on behalf of the elites and so on. And then at the same period, there's a whole other set of coups taking place. How do we understand the coup led by Gamal Abdel Nasser? Now, is Nasser's coup the same as the coup led by Augusto Pinochet? I would say no. Even Muammar al-Gaddafi, 1969, Colonel Gaddafi is a colonel, not a general. These fellows do coups. What's going on? In my view, those people, those Gaddafis, the Nassers and so on, they represent sections of the population that are not able to have political power in society. And they are unhappy. There's no avenue for them. And these lower ranked officers conduct a coup. They conduct a coup sometimes, by the way, merely because the troops haven't been paid. You know, the rank and file have not been paid. Often the reasons are extremely particular. They don't have a trade union. The coup is their trade union. But in many cases, they do a coup with a progressive agenda. The attempted coup, for instance, in Venezuela by Hugo Chavez in 1992 is also in that sense a captain's or colonel's coup. Hugo Chavez also leads on behalf of the rank and file. Why? Because the rank and file are people who come from the slums, people who come from peasant areas that have been completely discarded. Rank and file are people who come from peripheral towns where they've been without real jobs for a generation. This is what has been happening in the Sahel. When you look at the coups in Guinea, in Mali, in Burkina Faso, and in Niger, the people who've led the coup are often very young men, born 1988, born 1980, very young men for what they're doing. Also, these are young people come from these discarded towns, old cattle market towns, rural areas where the commodity prices have collapsed and so on. They see their families suffering for generations, not just, you know, some immediate problem because of inflation due to the Ukrainian war or inflation due to the pandemic, nothing. Generations of suffering and struggle. They see their fellow soldiers misused by the French as cannon fodder in a war, what they think is an unnecessary war against Al-Qaeda, against these smuggling groups and so on. There are other ways to fight the war. They have been very unhappy with them. In that sense, this is not the same. You know, this coup in Niger, for instance, it's not the same as the coup that took place in Chile 50 years ago. This is not a coup on behalf of the French or on behalf of the Americans or on behalf of the elites of Niger. It's in fact a coup on behalf of the ordinary people, which is why it has received mass support. You remember, David, when Muammar al-Gaddafi moved out of the barracks in 1969, not a shot was fired. I mean, the king had to flee the country immediately because mass support for the coup against the monarchy, against the so-called black hands of the monarch security services and so on. So that distinction to me is important. Now, the question people can ask is, why didn't they use other mechanisms? Good luck with that in a country like, say, Niger or Mali. You know, about 20-some years ago, now more, 25, I interviewed Alpha Omar Konare. He was the president of Mali. And I asked him, you know, he was a liberal man, came from a socialist background. I asked him, are you going to be able to move an agenda in Mali? And he said, look, I've inquired of the Clinton administration to please give me a debt haircut. We can't deal with the debt that we are carrying in Mali. If we can get a haircut on the debt, I can try to solve the problem with the Tuaregs. I can try to solve the problem of the Fulani. Lots of internal problems in Mali, he said, but we need resources to solve it. We need proper transportation between the north and the south. A good road to Timbuktu would help. You know, they didn't have a good road from Bamako to Timbuktu. The Clinton administration refused. They said, you have to honor your debt. Konare was out. The liberals left. They couldn't take it. They couldn't have an agenda. The socialists withered. Bazoum, you talked about Mohamed Bazoum of Niger. Mohamed Bazoum comes from a socialist party. You know, his party is a socialist party in name. It's called the Party of Socialism. But they have not been socialists for decades. They are basically caretakers for the United States, the French, and so on. U.S. has the largest drone base in the world in Agadez, Niger. These guys have become caretakers for the imperialist bloc. The young troops are frustrated. They don't have an avenue. There's no left formation. There's not even a right-wing formation in these countries. politics has been desiccated, David. When I traveled there, I was very surprised to see how frustrated ordinary people were and how frustrated the soldiers were. And that's why this is not a Pinochet coup. This is a coup led by young men who are desperate to save their country, but they really don't know how.
In an interview you did with Black Power Media, you talked about the Sahel region in Africa and how it was adversely affected by the U.S.-France-NATO attack on Libya, which later drove jihadi groups into northern Mali and into parts of Algeria also. I should add, Libya today remains in complete chaos. But talk about the significance of what happened there.
It's a fascinating terrain, David, because there's so much to unravel here. Let's actually start further south in the continent. You know, for the last 30, 35 years, there's been a serious economic problem in Ghana, Nigeria. These are the big countries of West Africa. Serious economic problem. No easy exit. And Nigeria is an oil-rich state. It's a scandal. So a large number of people from West Africa have wanted to migrate out of the region. These are mainly lower-middle-class people with some education. It's been hard to get away to migrate. You know, they've had to go by air to different places, raise lots of money, use different kinds of smugglers and so on. Park that point for a second, because that becomes really important to our story. Secondly, when the United States and France, particularly led by France, decided to destroy Libya in 2011, whatever, overthrow Gaddafi, destroy Libya, one and the same thing. The net accomplishment was the destruction of the Libyan state, okay? Whether they intended it or not, that's what happened. When they destroyed the Libyan state, forget the jihadis for a second, a doorway opens for mass migration from West Africa, joining migrants from Syria and Afghanistan. They all showed up in the coastal region of Libya, waiting to take boats across the Mediterranean. So that was crisis number one after the destruction of Libya. That's the only crisis Europe saw. When Europe saw that crisis, they said, we can't afford to have our border north of the Mediterranean Sea. We've got to move our border south of the Mediterranean Sea. So first, they tried to militarize the coastline of Libya, working with horrendous mafia-type groups, David, holding people in cells, selling people for slavery. You remember these stories right in the years 2012, 2013, now, of course, long forgotten. Europe worked openly, European coast guards colluding with mafia-type groups to prevent the boats from leaving. So first, they moved the border from north of the Mediterranean to south of the Mediterranean. Then, when the tide of migrants continued, they tried to move the border south of the Sahara. I interviewed people from the International Organization of Migration in Agadez, Niger, which is where the drone base is, met people, talked to them, and so on. They said they feel more people die in the Sahara than die in the Mediterranean. Crossing the Sahara is super perilous. You have to go from Agadez north to Sabah, Libya. You're crossing very dangerous terrain. There's really no good roads. All kinds of terrible things happen to people. So they feel more people die, as far as their data is concerned, trying to cross the Sahara than to cross the Mediterranean. But this was, of course, something that people were not seeing. They were just seeing the boats. So they successfully moved the border south of the Sahara into the Sahel region. Now, here comes France. France sets up something called G5 Sahel, where they were effectively paying the countries of the Sahel, you know, from Mauritania out to Chad, to militarize this area to prevent migration going north. That was really a big intervention by France, backed by the US. Why is there the world's largest drone base in Agadez? You ask somebody in the United States, they always say, oh, it's for Al-Qaeda. No, no, it's about the migration issue. They do surveillance to see where the migrants are going, interdiction of people moving northwards and so on. I'll come back to Al-Qaeda in a minute. The migration issue, which is the detritus of globalization, is the key to the French move south of the Sahara into the Sahel in such a big way. That's the other point, is that this G5 Sahel is created. Now, here, the European Union started to pay the countries of the Sahel to use artificial intelligence surveillance technology that is banned in Europe. I've raised this with people in the European Parliament saying, you please ask this question, because just a month ago, the European human rights body, Euromed, published a study where they proved this, that, you know, they are using technologies banned in Europe, but used in the Sahel again for interdiction of migration. So they're using these technologies. Now, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda. Of course, there's Al-Qaeda. I mean, the jihadis moved out of Libya. They moved to southern Algeria. You remember these attacks that took place at oil installations in southern Algeria right after the NATO war. That was the first salvo. But what the Al-Qaeda groups did, and what they're very good at doing, is that they made an alliance with three other forces. Number one, they made an alliance with Tuareg separatists in northern Mali, who have been fighting for years against the Malian state. This is not a national liberation movement. This is a very elitist Tuareg group that wants to dominate that region and keep it in their kind of tribal control. It's not exactly a progressive force, but nonetheless, it exists. Al-Qaeda made a connect with them. And the United States and France used the presence of Al-Qaeda in this to say war on terror have to go. And so France then directly intervenes in Mali, Burkina Faso, 2013, through Operation Barkhane. So you've got G5 Sahel to build this wall against migration. You've got illegal technologies being used there. You have now an intervention of troops both into Burkina Faso, Mali, and to some extent Niger. And you have this huge U.S. base in Niger. Meanwhile, France has old colonial exploits going on, including the leaching of uranium from Niger for generations. All of that protected now by military forces who say they are there to fight against Al-Qaeda. And the soldiers of the region have now said, this is a joke. Our problem is not Al-Qaeda. Our problem is you.
Well, talk about the uranium mines in Niger, which are mostly owned by French economic interests. So they have a huge stake in the economy of that country. And as you said, they have military forces there. They've been asked to leave by the new regime in Niamey. What's the likelihood of that happening?
So let's go to the Niger's uranium first. You know, the first major coup that takes place on African soil after 1945 is against the government of Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. And that was partly because the United States worried about a uranium mine in the Congo, from which they harvested the uranium for the two bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But this uranium mine in Arlit, which is in the northern part of Niger toward the Libyan border, the town of Arlit is garrisoned by the French. It's like a French overseas territory, okay? But again, let's wind around Arlit, because everybody now knows that one in three light bulbs in France is lit by the uranium of Arlit. But people may have forgotten something interesting about Niger and uranium. In the lead up to the illegal U.S. war on Iraq, the Bush administration made a weird statement saying Saddam Hussein's government has made a deal with Niger to get yellow cake uranium for their weapon of mass destruction. And you'll remember that a State Department official, former State Department official, was sent to Niger to go and see what the story was.
That was Joe Wilson.
That's it, Joe Wilson. When he came back to the U.S. and said, there's no evidence that Mr. Hussein and the Iraqi government getting uranium from Niger, his wife, who was a CIA agent, Valerie Plame, her name was leaked by the Bush administration. But what was interesting was, when that story came out, I remember thinking, my God, you think the people in the world are naive? How is Saddam Hussein going to send an emissary to Niger to try to get uranium? That uranium is not controlled by the government of Niger. That uranium is controlled by the French government. Effectively, it's a private French company. France garrisons the yellow cake mine. How is this, you know, Iraqi government going to make a deal? You must think we are real idiots. And in fact, sorry to say, but publications like the New York Times, Washington Post, none of them raised this question, is that Niger has sovereignty that is, to some extent, compromised. Its economic sovereignty compromised because France controls the uranium, as you said. Now, this government, for the first time in the history of Niger, has said that we are no longer going to export uranium to France. In fact, they have said, we want to take control of the mines. Now, this is going to be interesting. In many ways, the potential military intervention into Niger has much more to do with that uranium and to do with the question of migration than it has to do with anything else. They don't care about coups. When is the last time the United States bothered about a coup? You know, when the U.S. coup took place in Bolivia against Evo Morales or against Mel Zelaya in Honduras or twice against Aristide, it's not like the U.S. ever bothered to say, hey, this is an illegal coup. Please bring back the democratically elected. You know, it's a joke. They are worried about the uranium in this case. But again, and I'm sure we'll come back to this, the U.S. doesn't want to intervene by itself and France doesn't want to intervene militarily. And this is an interesting situation. Yes, the uranium is there. Yes, this new government is saying it's our uranium. We want to not only sell it at prices that benefit us, but we want very much to have control over the percentage of profit that we get and so on.
In your book, Washington Bullets, you recount the old joke. Why is there never a coup in the United States?
Because there's no U.S. embassy in the United States. I mean, you always got to see, are the lights on at night in the U.S. embassy? You know, if I'm a government, I wouldn't bother to try to do, you know, electronic surveillance of the U.S. embassy. Likelihood, you can't hear anything. But are the lights on in the offices? What are they up to? Are they busy like bees doing something nefarious? Who's going to see the ambassador and so on? Very interesting that you asked this question, because question is, why has the United States been silent all along here in Niamey? Now, yesterday, the French president, Elysee Palace, basically released a kind of statement saying the U.S. must join us in solidarity, because the new government has said that French troops have to leave, the 1,500 French troops. They haven't said that Air Base 201, the U.S. base, has to be shut down. This is an anti-French maneuver. It's not an anti-imperialist one as such. They are not calling for the U.S. to go. That is interesting. And in fact, it may be intelligent. It might be too much for a small country like this to take on both the United States and the French at the same time. Looks to me, they're going after the French first. And this has created anxiety in Paris. So the U.S. embassy in Niamey has been very quiet. And troops at Air Base 201 have been told to remain on base. Beyond that, we don't know. And I very much doubt that the U.S. will try to do anything in terms of a military intervention. It would be crazy.
Anthony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, also described Niger, and I'm quoting, a model of democracy. In that Black Power media interview, you said the region, the Sahel region, was not able to decolonize significantly against the French and were not able to get out from the claws of the International Monetary Fund. Why not?
Well, one of the main reasons is when independence took place in 1661, when Charles de Gaulle finally said, okay, you guys can have your independence. We're not going to fight you like we're fighting the Algerians. You know, remember, the French focus was on defeating the FLN in Algeria. That was where they really put their guns in. They couldn't fight in Algeria and across the Sahel. Not that there was any indication that the Sahel leaders were going to go into armed struggle, but they were fierce in determination to have their independence. So when they got their independence, part of the deal was that they would continue to use a French currency. It was called a colonial franc. You know, France uses the euro, but the Sahel countries use the franc. And 50% of their reserves have to be held in the Bank of France. I mean, it's extraordinary that independent countries by treaty have to keep their reserves, foreign exchange reserves, in a foreign bank, which then benefits because it has all this money and it earns interest on it and it's able to lend against it, stabilize its own monetary system, but not these countries. So that's the first way you can see no real sovereignty. Secondly, there was almost an open clause that when needed, French troops can return. And in fact, you know, in 2013, that is 53 years after independence of Mali, that kind of treaty was utilized for French troops to come back. Sovereignty was very much compromised. But the third reason is the real reason. How do you get out of being an exporter of raw materials? This is inclusive of Ghana. Exports gold, doesn't have gold reserves. You know, Britain has no gold, but it has gold reserves. How do you teach a child that? That here's Ghana, used to be called the Gold Coast, major producer of gold in the world, doesn't really have gold reserves. How do you explain to a child the illogical nature of the last 200-300 years of history? Okay, how do these countries move from being single commodity exporters, you know, uranium, gold, whatever, to being more developed, diversified economies? You need credit. And to get credit, many of these countries went to the World Bank and the IMF and international creditors. Africa is drowning in a debt crisis. Countries are basically only able to service the debt. They're not paying the debt. They are paying the interest on the debt. I mean, they are buried under interest payments. Forget paying for the principal. They are still paying the interest because they're ballooning rates of debt. It's sovereign debt crisis in Africa is a catastrophe. You know, it doesn't get talked about enough. Tricontinental did a really good study called Life or Debt, where we looked at the totality of the sovereign debt crisis, the exposure of African countries to the Eurobond market and so on. It's quite catastrophic. So you borrow to develop. Problem is, when you start building an agenda, you get knocked out. And I don't want to sound conspiratorial about it, just sounding historical. So many years ago in the 1960s, Mali, Guinea, then Upper Volta, they all started to talk about building a federation. Because these countries, even though they're not small countries, you know, 20 million, 30 million at the time, they still felt if they built a big regional bloc, they could trade amongst each other. They were, many of them, landlocked countries and so on. That federation idea collapsed, and that was not a good thing. Secondly, at the collapse of the federation, just as the West Indian Federation idea collapsed around the same time in the Caribbean, emerges one or two leaders who tried to drive a left agenda. Most important and significant, of course, was Thomas Sankara of Upper Volta, named then he changes to Burkina Faso, tries to build an agenda, talks about the debt crisis, talks about agriculture, talks about food sovereignty and so on. And of course, he's assassinated in 1987. So, you know, sovereignty is hard to piece together for these countries. Every time they try to stand up, they are either killed or their projects are set aside. It's interesting. Ibrahim Traore of Burkina Faso is now wearing the red beret of Sankara. I don't know what he's read. I don't know what economics he knows. Or I don't know any of that. But I do know that he comes from the soil where this Sankaraism is just not disappearing. It continues to inspire in Burkina Faso generation upon generation of young people.
You're listening to Vijay Prashad on Africa, from neoliberalism to independence. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Events in Niger have the editors of the New York Times worried. Their front page story says, I'm quoting, "Niger coup may slow U.S. fight against terror, bolstering Russia. A loss of drone bases would be a blow." Now, we mentioned that Niger has large amounts